This is the GameStreet.biz microcast for Monday, the 11th of March, 2024. I am James Batchelor, Editor-in-Chief of GameStreet.biz, and I'm joined today, as ever, by Chris Stringe, Head of GameStreet.biz. Chris, busy week for you diving into charts numbers, which, to be fair, I know puts you in your element.
Ah, it's a joyful time of the month when I'm going through the GSD and GFK figures and seeing what's doing well. Which is Helldivers, by the way. Helldivers is doing well.
Good. Yeah. That hadn't come across. No, it's brilliant to see that doing so well. Like it's first kind of major. I know we had Pal World before, but first like major hit of the year from like an established studio, established brand, etc.
Pal World data isn't in the charts because the charts are only the bigger companies, and we talked about this in the previous podcast, but. So obviously that would probably be in there as well. But Helldivers, Skull and Bones didn't do so well. Not initially anyway. And we haven't had a great start for Suicide Squad. I think that's been quite public. I'll be honest, there's games that have done a lot worse. It's not been a great month for those games. But in a year, this time last year, February had Hogwarts last year. And it was phenomenally successful. And really, the market to be only down a little bit compared to this. Like, I take that.
It's impressive. Like did you say, like it's only down like 5.5% is what I've read. I think.
Yeah, for the UK, I'm still doing UK, Europe. And Circana estimates that we'll be down about 10% at best this year. And I can't disagree with that. I think it's going to be one of those years.
As you say, that's not bad in comparison with the Hogwarts launch. And then like I think it was the Elden Ring launch was the February before. So like February's have been huge the last couple of years. So to have a quieter February is
Well, Circana were doing, that's their estimate for the full year would be a decline. Right. And that's partly because there's no blockbusters and it's because, you know, the consoles are maturing and there's not that suddenly influx of new stock driving sales up. So we expect hardware sales to fall. There aren't that many massive games. It's obviously an opportunity for everyone else. But it means that the numbers won't necessarily look great. But, you know, if a few Helldivers 2 like this, you never know. We might get not far off.
I think on the next one, a lot of people are looking forward to is Dragon's Dogma 2. I think that one stands.
Well, I don't know if they're looking forward to it out of, like, I don't know if in last year they'd have looked forward to it. I'm not saying they wouldn't have looked forward to it. Like, people like Dragon's Dogma. But it's I don't know if it would be up there with one of the most anticipated games if there was anything else out.
No, that's
true. But yeah, it's a great opportunity for Capcom. I think anyone that's got a big game coming out in the next, or a big game by that in their minds in the next 12 months will have a chance. A good chance. Yeah.
They're all quite hopeful. Like, I spoke to Bandai Namco's Hervé Hode on about Unknown 9. Unknown 9 Awakening, the new like action adventure, but it's like got a whole transmedia thing around it. And I asked, like, you know, the fact that this is coming out in the summer and there's not as much coming out in 2024 in general. And his words were literally, I can only be happy that there's not more competition, because that's the sort of game that would get overlooked. I know, we don't know how that one's going to perform, but that's the sort of game that absolutely would get drowned out by other
games. We've talked about this in the last few podcasts, haven't we? And we had Thomas and Remy talking. And the thing is, because there's not a lot out generally, it means even if your game doesn't have a great launch, it might find an audience a little bit later through sales and activity and DLC. And we're seeing that now with, like, you know, we saw Alan Wake's done 300,000 units in January, which was, you know, I think it's probably their biggest month. And we saw the Immortals of Avium article. They said that they've had their best sales between December and January as well. So it's because things got quieter. And I think opportunity for smaller devs, but the overall, the numbers aren't going to look wonderful.
Last tangent, I do wonder, you said about the long tail sales, I do wonder if that will apply to Skull and Bones, because obviously, like, came out, didn't launch particularly well, and then a month later, Sea of Thieves is coming to PlayStation, which is, like, the closest competitor. So, and anecdotally, like, it's been doing the rounds over the weekend that Sea of Thieves is the most pre-ordered game on PlayStation Store at the moment. So, like, at the top of the pre-order charts. And that, to me, is still just hilarious, seeing, like, an Xbox game.
Well, I've said this before. Rare game on PlayStation. I'm not sure I can cope with this. Sea of Thieves, as much as Sea of Thieves and Skull and Bones are both pirate games, right? And I did compare them in the UK charts. 75% bigger launch Sea of Thieves had. What I will say is They are quite different games.
They are. Very, very different. Very yeah. different target demographic. Yeah. Very different kind of mechanics. So, yeah. But it's just... Battle of the Pirate Games is just... we can't help... We're journalists. We can't help but draw conclusions where... You know, comparisons, sorry, where we want to.
Yeah, Skull and Bones won't be happy. There's another pirate game on the market. No. That looks similar. We'll have similar marketing and stuff attached to it. But they are... Yeah. Yeah. Oh, we'll have to see what happens with it. If Ubisoft support it long term or if... they write it off. We'll see.
Let's talk about some news. Biggest stories of the past week. We've got three of them here. Last week was surprisingly busy news-wise. Like, I think we went into the microcast with Thomas last week, thinking like, well, we've got a few things we can talk about. And then this week, this morning I was like, hang on, we've got to talk about that. We've got to talk about this. Probably should talk about that. There's a few other things we could have done. We've narrowed it down to three, so let's crack on. First one I want to kind of bring up is the ongoing scuffle between Apple, Epic Games, and the European Union. So very short version, because I honestly can't get into the war of words at this time of the morning, is Apple banned or blocked Epic Games' developer account, which means it would not be able to release Fortnite on iOS again, and it wouldn't be able to launch its own app store, which has been enabled by the European Union's Digital Markets Act that has now forced Apple to open its ecosystem to other app stores. There were, like I say, war of words. There were many, many words, but the words verifiably untrustworthy were two of the words used by Apple. I can kind of see why, but we'll get onto that in a second. Epic obviously complained, a lot of kind of grumbling. The European Commission then reached out to Apple to request further explanations behind this decision. And a day later, Epic reported that Apple has reinstated or is reinstating its developer account. So plans for Fortnite to return to iOS and the Epic Games Store are moving forward. The conversation around this has kind of evolved beyond... This is not just an Apple versus Epic thing that's been going on since 2020. This is more Apple versus the EU. And Apple is trying its absolute damnedest to technically comply with the Digital Markets Act, but still kind of have as much control over its ecosystem as possible. We've already talked about
and charge them all the extra tax.
Exactly, yeah. The extra charge is like, yes, you can launch an alternative app store on iOS, but we'll be taking a 17% charge of all all transactions. Thank you very much. And if your store wants to use our Apple payment system, that's another 3% charge. Thank you very much. And yeah, so Apple's the block against Apple, sorry, the block against Epic. The one point I can kind of see, like when they're like verifiably untrustworthy and all these kind of harsh words.
Epic are a pest.
Epic are a pest.
From Apple. No, no, not to the industry, but to Apple. They're an absolute pest, right?
Yeah.
In the first place they made the moves, we're talking about back in 2020 when they allowed people to buy Fortnite stuff at a discount through their own store.
I mean,
to provoke a reaction. Yeah.
Yeah. It was a breach of a developer agreement. Like you've got a company who has proven they're going to do. Breach your development agreement because they've done it before. They've taken you to court over it, saying they're justified to breach your agreement. I can understand why.
And that, you know, it may not have been the only reason, but it's also helped lead to the DMA in the first place, a Digital Markets Act in the first place. And then you've got, and suddenly Apple are sort of this, you know, people, it's Tim Sweeney's quote, malicious compliance around this DMA in sort of implementation. And then Apple got annoyed with Epic over it. Beautifully. I mean, Epic must be sitting there going, you fell for this beautifully, right? And then they blocked their developer account and Epic just made that public, which have got the European Commission to come and look at them again, right? And it's this legitimately like, Epic they just want to be a real nuisance to Apple and they are successfully being it. And I'll be honest with you, I'm surprised Apple, I'm not sure Apple, it felt stupid to me to block the account out of what feels like spite in a bit.
That's the thing. It did come across as a very kind of petty move. So Rob Fahey, our contributing editor, wrote a whole kind of column on this, on Apple's attitudes and why this is, like I said, much bigger than just Epic. Apple versus Epic. Good Lord, I can't handle words this morning. That this is more about Apple versus EU and the kind of the Apple constantly trying to find ways of complying but without complying. And
yeah, they're going to lose this. I don't know what they're playing at, right?
No.
I'll be honest, I think this is... Apple have always had a bad reputation in the games industry, right? I know that they've got the platform that makes loads of money for developers and everyone's... And they've been broadly okay with it. And Apple Arcade was a cool thing when they did it. I know they sort of scaled it back a bit. But the... Apple's... Everyone always thought Apple don't care about games. Games were a means to help them sell their hardware. And that's been a perception. Whether that's true or not, that's how the industry's always felt towards Apple. They've always said it. They've never really been accepted as a games company. They've always been seen as like just a, they just own a, they're just like they're not really, they're just like Dell isn't a games company, right? It's, they don't really, they're just over there, they don't really like games, but you know, they've got a platform that's quite popular for it. So game developers don't like them, or at least they're not warm to them anyway. And then to do this, and it's I just yeah. I just have to think, they're just playing the villain, and they need to, they're going to lose. Right, this is the thing. They will eventually be forced, you know, globally, to open up their platform in a way that they're not comfortable with. And rather than being a, you know, work, make it work for you, right? Work. But here's the thing: Microsoft didn't want to open up its platform either with Windows, and look where they are now, right? Mm. It doesn't have to be doing this. Doesn't have to lead to it might some short term pain, sure, but it doesn't have to be. It could open up opportunities long term for Apple. And I'm just sort of fed up with them. I just think to stop.
So is Epic from the sounds of it.
Yeah, and everyone loves them. Everyone's a bit. I think there's a few people in the industry that's a bit like, oh, Epic are why you know, it's like that Epic can afford to be it. They're massive. They're independent. They can afford to be a real nuisance. And it's, I love them or hate them. I kind of like them for what they're doing. But I think it's about just. Just embrace the reason why this is happening is because you've been so successful, and use it as a means to, you know, to spark on. We all know how much competition is good for markets and how it's good for individual businesses as well. So I'm just a bit.
As you say, it's going to change. Like, you know, the conversation globally is changing over walled gardens, particularly on things like mobile, which is kind of such a ubiquitous device. And every, you know, everyone uses mobile. Like, it's general purpose hardware, isn't it? It's not like a, you know, walled gardens, I think, are still going to exist on consoles because they are a dedicated hardware for a dedicated purpose, i.e. gaming and, to an extent, entertainment, whereas smart devices are used for so damn much. Like, this obviously is happening in the EU with the Digital Markets Act, but, you know, Apple is still facing changes in the US. So the Apple versus Epic, the actual court case, the ruling and stuff all got sorted out kind of just before Christmas. And yeah, like all appeals have failed. The original ruling stands, and Apple does now need to enable third-party payments or direct payments. But again, they've done it where they enable it, but they take a 27% charge on any transactions made through alternative links. So like, it's still kind of clinging to all that kind of control and revenue it can, and it's fighting against the tide. And yeah. I'm intrigued to see what other markets, kind of EU and US, two massive markets, obviously.
Yeah,
once
markets that size have started doing it, you sort of, if everything tends to fall in line. I don't know. If I worked for Apple, I'd be sitting there going, "Goodness sake!" It's just like I know. It's money and it's revenue and it's you know, your ecosystem that you've built and you've supported, but there comes a point where it's become bigger than you. So, you know, embrace it rather than fight it. Anyway, they'll lose eventually.
They will lose eventually. Speaking of losing, we move on to our next story, which is the Nintendo and Yuzu legal dispute. Tropic Haze, the creator of the Switch emulator Yuzu, has not so much lost, that was a terrible segue. They have settled. They've agreed to a settlement with Nintendo. So Nintendo took legal action against the company Tropic Haze. The Tropic Haze employed some lawyers, because when Nintendo lawyers are knocking down on your door, you better have some lawyers to answer them. And they have agreed to pay $2.4 million in a settlement to Nintendo. They've agreed to give up the domain name to Nintendo of America. They've deleted all of the circumvention tools that they had for their program. This is not just affecting Yuzu. This is also affecting Citra, which is a Nintendo 3DS simulator. This all turned around quite quickly. Like, I think it's been the space of a week between Nintendo is going after Yuzu, Nintendo and Yuzu have settled. Like, it was quite a quick turnaround. The conversation around this has become a lot kind of broader. Like, we were saying just before on air, there's a lot of conversation about how litigious Nintendo can be and how aggressively it goes over emulators. But the one point people can see quite reasonable is, in this instance, user was emulating its current active console. Like, it wasn't emulate. It's harder to kind of fight against emulators for things like Game Boy, N64, etc., because the argument can always be made for preservation. And it's a very kind of legal grey area around, you know, emulation and whether it's allowed for preservation purposes. You're not preserving The Legend of Zelda Tears of the Kingdom if people are able to download it a week before release, you know. So it's a very kind of
different thing. It's a really woody, because also even the 3DS bit you could argue is preservation, but Nintendo are rolling out all of its games onto a subscription service, and you could, you know, it's like, obviously that's not the same as preserving, but then it's complicated. But look, Nintendo are going to fight. I was there. I wrote extensively about the Nintendo R4 card, right? Mm. And I think we forget how... It's interesting, not just Nintendo. I'll quickly mention PS2. I did it for Jim Ryan, it was a little while ago, so the outgoing PlayStation CEO, about their most, you know, will they ever top the PS2? And his view is, like, we top the PS2 of every subsequent games console because we weren't hit by massive piracy, right? And it was a really interesting to hear him say that, because it was the games weren't a lot of money, they didn't make a lot of revenue off the hardware either, and there's so much piracy on the device that, you know, ever since then they've enjoyed more success. But Nintendo, the DS, man, that, and here's the thing, that does impact consumers. I don't think people realize the impact that had on gamers, because GTA Chinatown Wars, right, was actually a failure of a game. Amazing game, brilliant game, heavily promoted. And you could argue it was the wrong audience, it was the wrong platform. But I can't remember the exact number, but I'm pretty sure Nintendo told me it had been downloaded illegally 10 times more than it sold, right? It might even been more than that. It might have been exceptionally more than that. I can't remember. All of those aren't sales. In fact, the majority of them won't be sales. People perhaps wouldn't have planned to buy it anyway. But the R4 card was ubiquitous. You could buy it on Amazon.
You can still buy them on Amazon. Brendan did a whole piece on this, like, just before Christmas. Like, Amazon is still openly selling or enabling people to sell R4 cards, and like for DS and 3DS, you can buy. Yeah.
Yeah. Well, but back then it was Amazon was selling it like through their own. directly themselves. Yeah. And it was everywhere. Every retailer, apart from maybe Game and some of the ones that are a little bit closer to Nintendo, were selling it. All the indie shops are selling it. It was prevalent. And if you were, okay, maybe if you were more casual owner on the DS, you didn't use it. But it meant that, and I did a couple of chats. So Take-Two said that they would evaluate future DS opportunities after Chinatown Wars, which meant they didn't do another game like Chinatown Wars on the DS. They didn't do another game like that on 3DS either. A couple of casual games, they did not do that anymore. The second thing that happened is I had a chat with Square Enix, who were also severely impacted by R4 popularity in their minds. And they said they were scaling back their DS support, right? So gamers actually got fewer games they would have got on their DS as a result of the R4 card. Even if it turned out the R4 card didn't cost a single sale, the perception that it did, and I think it's hard to argue it didn't, but the perception that it did was enough to put off games companies supporting that platform. Mm. And that's a problem. So now Nintendo, every time it looks like something's bobbling up, it will come down with, but it's coming down on them. Because if they can make it difficult, if they can make it awkward for you to pirate, you know, they're never going to quite kill it off. They're never going to do that. But if they can make it as difficult and awkward as possible, it will keep it being a niche. It'll keep it being something that people on, you know, hardcore gamers on forums do. Mm. You know, it's easier just to loop up the eShop, and if you fine, I'll pay the 10 quid and get the thing, right? So it's obviously the bigger games a little bit different. But yeah, Nintendo, I'm not surprised, based on what happened with that DS and the impact it had and the relationship impact it had on their partners and actually the impact it had on the games that came out on it, I'm not surprised. I think Nintendo will always fight it really, really hard. And it's their job. Their job is not to stop it.
No.
Their job is just to make it a pain in the ass to do.
Nintendo, no, I agree. Nintendo's always going to fight against this. And like, you know, Rob wrote a great column on the Nintendo user dispute, and he argued quite convincingly that piracy affects all companies in the industry and all platform holders in the industry, but Nintendo has perhaps been impacted the most. I mean, certainly most prominently, like, you know, the R4 cards, etc. Like, you know, they were so easy to get. You know, Nintendo faces slightly larger problems with piracy and so forth, and they are more reliant on getting you into their ecosystem. And like, you know, age old Nintendo, you know, factors, things like, you know, the fact that first party titles are the biggest sales drivers, so they need to protect those games from being pirated. The fact that this is almost a catch 22. The value of Nintendo games so rarely drops. Like, you know, the Zelda's £70. Maybe you'll see it drop to 60 or 50 in some sort of discount, but you won't see it drop below that. Gone are the days of, you know, games dropping to... There were times when, you know, most games used to drop to like 20, 30 quid or like a few months after launch. Nintendo games never drop that low. Like, I mean, blimey, even if you go into... If you buy like 3DS games or Wii U games, you know, in you know, something like CEX or something, or even, you know, even launch games for Switch are still full price now. Like, those never come down. It's catch 22 because like that kind of, I imagine, compels some people to piracy.
But it's partly the audience Nintendo goes for, right? So when people pick up a Switch, Mario Kart 8 is as new for them as, you know, it's the way they sort of their games don't drop in value. And perhaps that's the reason why some of the other platform holders, some of the other companies are not so bothered about it in quite an aggressive way, because, you know, oh, you're pirating our £10 version of, you know, that sort of stuff. But Nintendo value sustainable. They're sustainable. They're all about sustainability and, you know, growing steadily and protecting their IP. Because also when games start being emulated and people start editing them and all, and okay, it happens en masse. It's one of the reasons they're so cross on YouTube about how things are presented, right? They don't want kids discovering Mario through any means that's not controlled by them. But
no,
there is a genuine concern about preservation. And here's the thing, it's really difficult conversation with Nintendo, because Nintendo kind of rely on that back catalogue to continually bring in revenue for them all the time, right? They're constantly going, here's Mario again. Here's Mario. I think I own seven copies of Mario 64 over various different generations. Now I subscribe to Nintendo Switch Online, I will hopefully won't need to buy it again for a while. However, I'm always giving Nintendo money on a monthly basis for it, or I think it's a yearly basis.
This is until you find out that you know Switch 2 won't have the same Switch Online subscription.
I would be shocked if they did that. I would be absolutely shocked because they haven't finished all those games
we bought on Virtual Console and then had to buy them again on the next Virtual Console.
But that's different because I'm still having to give them money for this. Like, I'm not. It's not like they're taking it away to have to buy it again. At least I understand why they would do that. Like, they have to make it work on the new platform. I would be shocked if they... I wouldn't be surprised if Nintendo Switch Online in the future becomes something you can get on your phone.
That would be
cool. You know, retro Nintendo collection.
That's one of those things that we say, and we know that that's a good idea and people should do, and that they should do it, and therefore Nintendo determinedly will not do it.
They won't be in a hurry to do it because it's added value for their platform. But, like, you know, their controllers they've made for it, they work on PCs, right? So if you're starting to go, you know, is it that far-fetched to think some of them might end up on a, you know, if Nintendo can keep your ecosystem, it's maybe. Not. I don't think it'll be anything they do soon.
We've veered into speculation, so I'm going to bring this to our final story before we wrap up. So the other thing a lot of people were talking about last week were comments by Warner Brothers, specifically by CEO and President of Global Streaming and Games, J.B. Perrett. This was during an earnings call around Warner Brothers Discovery's results. There were a few comments on the console market, so I'm going to read these verbatim. He was talking about the console business. He was saying, the challenge we've had is our business historically in games has been very AAA console based. That's a great business when you have a hit like Harry Potter. It makes the year look amazing. And when you don't have a release, or unfortunately we also have disappointments, we've just released Suicide Squad this quarter, which was not strong, it just makes it very volatile. Perrett's answers to this volatility are two main things. Is one is pushing more into mobile and multi-platform free-to-play games, which could give us a much better and more consistent set of revenue. He suggested that there's going to be more mobile free-to-play games later this year. And the second was through live services. And this is the comment that a lot of people got quite uppity about. So rather than launching one and done console game, how do we develop a game around, for example, Hogwarts Legacy or Harry Potter, that is a live service where people can come in and live and work and build and play in that world on an ongoing basis? Now, the timing of this comparison isn't marvellous. So having just mentioned in almost the same breath Suicide Squad, a AAA live service game which has struggled at launch, and then suggesting they should go more in that direction than Hogwarts Legacy, which is not just the best-selling game of last year, but the first game that wasn't Call of Duty and wasn't a Rockstar title to top the US charts.
If you go back to the previous 12 months, it was Lego Star Wars The Skywalker Saga, which was one of the top three games selling games of the year, which is also a single-player story narrative-driven, and the big one, made by Warner Brothers. So they had two hits on the bounce. And they're not. Here's the thing, they're not wrong, right? You know, if they can build something that, you know, you can have years, we don't have a big, you know, Take-Two's a great example of it. I'm pretty sure they had a whole generation where they didn't release anything. But it was kind of okay, because GTA Online, Red Dead Redemption 2. But just to sort of keep things sort of flowing for them. And obviously NBA and stuff. I'm going too much into that Take-Two. But that's an example of being, if you've got a big live service game that could bring those sort of money in. And you look at a game like Harry Potter and you think, could we create a metaverse Potter game? But Brendan's opinion piece, by the way, is exactly what I feel about this. Warner Brothers need to play to the strengths of the things they've got. Right? Like, if they've got... And here's the thing. What is even live service these days? Because here's the thing. I'd argue Hogwarts Legacy 1 and done, still in the top 10 now. Right? It's not one and done. It's still selling now. And here's the thing. It might even, you know, you're going to do an update and you're going to expand it and you're going to give more things on it. And it's going to keep selling. In fact, it's been in the charts consistently in the top 10, sometimes in the top, mostly in the top 5. It's almost GTA levels of consistency. Okay, GTA has been going for 11 years now. But it's showing such legs. And here's a game, The Witcher kept selling and selling and selling for decades after Skyrim. Now, these games are big, epic, fantasy, role-playing experiences that people come back to and come back to, and they spread and the audiences get bigger and bigger and bigger of each generation. Is that live service? That's not the live service they're talking about, is it? They're talking about free-to-play and microtransactions and monetization. They're not talking about a game that just sells and sells and sells and sells. But the results are the same. It's recurrent revenue from one invested product, one product that you've released. They've got Lord of the Rings, for crying out loud. Right, they've got the original fantasy epic, right? Build us an Elden Ring.
Hang on, because Embracer owns Lord of the Rings, don't they?
But don't, I thought they did have a... Am I getting that?
Hang on. I imagine Warner's got rights to the film versions of Lord of the Rings and The Hobbit, whereas the general and Tolkien rights are now Embracer owned.
Yeah, I might have to look into that. They've also got Harry Potter, right? Which I know they've done with Hogwarts Legacy. And it's like, these are the things that you can... monetized. The thing is, superhero comic books aren't built for live service. Like, we've seen it. They tried it with the Avengers. Like, massive AAA super talented development teams who are experts at this have tried it. And they just went, you know what, actually, this I don't think the IP fits with the story element of the IP. And it fits, you might be able to get some cool character-based stuff. But fits with this model. You know, I think, you know, superhero film games have to be 20, 25 hour long. It has to be Spider-Man 2, basically. And I just, yeah, I'm a bit, I'm a little bit when it comes to those sort of comments. Like, but they're not wrong, though. They could do with recurrent revenue, I think, from it. It's just,
I think it was just a very oddly worded an oddly worded comparison, and it comes at a time when, I mean, Suicide Squad has been a big part of this conversation, like a conversation around, you know, whether or not live service or games as a service, like the business model itself, is as reliable or as guaranteed a hit as some executives seem to think. Like, there's a whole conversation about whether or not, you know, live services games are viable anymore because there's so damn many about them. And again, I'm recognizing that live service is a very kind of broad term, could mean anything at this point. Loads of people do mean it in different ways. But at a time when people are talking about, like, you know, there's consumer resistance against some live service games, it's incredibly challenging to bring out a new live service game or a new games as a service title in a very, very competitive market, because people are still playing GTA Online, Fortnite, etc. Like, for an executive to then be saying, oh yeah, we're going to double down on this, it just felt a little kind of, not tone deaf, that's not the word, but like kind of a little kind of oblivious to the actual challenges that are out there.
Yeah. So. Yeah, it's not easy, right? No. You know, launching a live service game it's really hard, and you're competing in a market dominated by existing players. And it's also, it costs a lot of money.
Last thing I'd say, the risk of talking over you, so sorry. The last thing I'd say is, like, the IP is absolutely no guarantee of success. Like, we saw this with Avengers. Avengers, in the beginning, an Avengers game seemed like a surefire hit. or at least when it was first announced. But Harry Potter, like, I was convinced Harry Potter, I can't remember, I keep on calling it Harry Potter Go. What was the Niantic's game?
Yeah.
Harry Potter Wizards Unite. I was convinced that that was going to be hit. Like, you know, the only IP that could have been bigger than Pokemon for a Pokemon Go style location-based game was Harry Potter. Died within 2 years.
But that's because here's the thing, Pokemon Go, right? Pokemon Go, it's Pokemon, right? And it's the thing, you play that game, sure, it's the way you go out on your adventures and stuff, it's a little bit different. There's no real story to it in the exact same way. But it's that you capture Pokemon, you train them up, you collect them all, you go to gyms. Like, it's a Pokemon game. And they went, how do we put Pokemon in the real... And they used it was a perfect example of the use of the IP with technology and live service. I'm not saying they can't do it. And I understand they're investing in it. It's a shame if they don't, if they're investing, you know, if Rex say they go, oh, Rocksteady, you need to make another live service game. And don't go, just make a Batman game.
Yes.
You know, look at, make an open world Batman game. Batman Arkham World. That'll do wonders, absolute wonders. It's a huge
idea. Absolutely, yes.
But anyway.
Equally, it's going to be really weird if like Hogwarts Legacy 2 is more like Suicide Squad than it is like Hogwarts Legacy. But that's not necessarily what they're saying.
No, it's talk about future. It's also, they're talking to shareholders. They want to say certain
things.
By the way, I think Warner Brothers own the copyrights to the movies, but they don't actually, Embracer own all the game stuff. So, you know, they just ignore that.
In my moment of victory, finally having proven Chris wrong on something after 18 years of working together, or nearly 18 years of working together, we're going to wrap this up. We're going to be back next week as always, although no, you won't, because you're going to be at GDC.
Yeah, well, who knows, I might be around.
You cannot do the microcast jet lagged at 3 a.m. or whatever time it's going to be there.
I'm sure I could manage
I'm sure you could manage it. Okay, right, we'll have this argument when we finish. Thank you so much for joining us. Thank you so much for watching if you're on the YouTube channel. Thank you so much for listening if you're listening on the podcasting platform of your choice. The podcasting platform of your choice is obviously where you can find all the previous microcasts and full episodes of the podcast, etc. We are going to be back next Monday. I will be. I don't know if Chris will be. We'll see. We're going to have that argument soon. And in the meantime, you can get more news, insight and analysis into the world behind video games at gamesindustry.biz.